Okay. What I wanted to talk about tonight was give an overview of the practice from like about 30,000 feet and cover a lot of big features real quickly. And so if you've been doing the practice for a while, perhaps this will give you a chance to review some of the connections of all these lists and things like that. And if you're just starting, maybe this will give you a reference point. You can fit in some of the other things you'll hear or read and say, ah, I see, it goes here. So first let me ask, how many people have been here 6 times or 6 months or less? Okay, great. Okay. And how many people feel comfortable with the difference between concentration and insight meditation? Okay, good. So we have a good balance here tonight. Okay. Okay. The Buddha, somebody once asked the Buddha, says, what's your teaching? And this was a common question back then. There are all these people, all these teachers all over, and somebody would come up and say, you know, I want the Cliff's Notes version and the Buddha said, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. And that in itself is actually a shortened version of the Four Noble Truths, where the Buddha said, there is suffering. I know the cause of suffering, and it's nothing. It's not random chance. It's not angry gods. It's how we react to things. It's whether we cling to our experiences. The good news is that there's an end to this, and the better news is that I've worked it out. There's an eightfold path. There's a program. There's our eight specific things you can do in terms of attitudes and actions that will help you get free of all of that. And he actually, at several time places during the suttas, he talks about what's called the gradual training. And this is kind of a review, kind of a curriculum for a monk. This is, okay, a monk gets ordained and it comes in one end, gets ordained, and then over here is becoming an arhat. So we're going to review that whole thing from 30,000 feet. And the now, when Buddha started talking about, you know, what the end of this path was, he talked a little bit about nirvana and gave some descriptions that were just, you know, very attractive, but not too specific. And when people asked him for more specifics, he would say, no, I'm not going there. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that he says that one reason was that it's so different from our normal experience and the language used to talk about that I really can't explain it to you. But more importantly, the difference was Buddha didn't want to get off into metaphysical constructs, all those philosophical ideas. He wanted to return us to thinking about our own experience. So rather than, and how we could change our reaction to that experience. So rather than talk about nirvana to tell us where things were going, what the Buddha would talk about, he had several lists of the major problems we were going to solve. One of the shortest lists is the list of the three roots of unskillful actions: greed, hate, and delusion. Now, when you say greed or hate, it doesn't have to be in its extreme form to qualify for the list. A mild preference for it not raining tomorrow still makes the list in terms of greed, because it's an attachment. Hate doesn't have to be strong. It can be a mild preference for something not happening, something that wouldn't even make your radar screen during the day unless you got very, very calm and very, very very concentrated and could look at it carefully. There are a couple other lists that are longer. The one's called the asavas, and that's a hard word to translate, so many people get it. Depending on your translator, that'll be called the fetters. That'll be called the effluence, the influx, the taints, or the cankers. So you can read different translations and find all of those words, and they're talking about the same thing. Another list is called the fetters, samyojana. and that's about 10 items on that list. And both of those turn up in the suttas a lot. So you talk tonight, we'll read some things when the taints will come up. The one you hear off a similar list that serves the same purpose that you hear more often is the kilesas. And you don't read about that in the suttas as much because they didn't have the list formulated back then. But since then, teachers have kind of formulated the list, and it's a great one for Dharma talks because it has the three roots of unskillful actions in it, greed, hate, and delusion, and it's got the five fetters in it, five hindrances in it. We'll talk about those tonight too. So it's a great multi-purpose list. So that's what the Buddha did. And we're going to talk about how that's the problem that he set out to start. And what we want to talk about tonight is how he organized the training for that. And kind of the armature or the broad outline, the top-level outline of this gradual training goes into is broken up into three parts. One, the samadhi or morality, and that's the first part. Samadhi or concentration, and then panya or wisdom. And that in itself is actually a rearrangement or a partition of the Eightfold Path. But in sila, the purpose of sila is to keep us from harming ourselves or harming each other, and that's with words or actions. And that, those are called in the language of those are called the transgressive defilements. That's actual actions. You actually go out and actually say something mean to Lewis or hit Richard. So that's the purpose of that is to keep us from is to keep us from causing ourselves and each other problems in daily life. The next stage of that threefold training is to suppress momentary or temporary suppression of the kilesas or the asavas or the fetters while we're in the process of meditating. So we protect ourselves while we're meditating, but once we get up, they can come back. Maybe they won't come back quite as strong, etc., but they're not gone. And the Buddha found that out. One of the first things he did when he left his castle as a prince was to go out and master the concentration meditation available at the time. And he said, this is great. As long as I'm doing this concentration meditation, and he went all the way to the top. He says, as long as I'm doing this, things are great. But when I get up, I know I'm not free. And he wanted something more. And that's the last stage. That's the panya, the wisdom stage. And that's where these fetters, the kleshas, get uprooted completely. And they get uprooted in definite stages. So there's at the first stage of the first real attainment on this path of the gradual training is being a stream enterer. And that is, it's called a stream enterer or sotapanna, because if you take something and you throw it out in the middle of the stream, it'll ultimately make it to the ocean. And that's the idea that once you had entered the stream, gotten into the middle, getting into the stream of Dharma, you would ultimately, within seven lifetimes is the guarantee, be enlightened. And let's see, I've got my list here. So the kind of defilements that get uprooted there are basically two. There's uncertainty in the training. I mean, we may think, oh yeah, meditation's great stuff, etc. But then you have a personal illness, something goes wrong in the family, and maybe you're not so sure about the Dharma. But with the at sotapanna, you have unshakable faith in the Dharma, I've been told. And the other kilesa that gets uprooted or speculative views, or the personality belief that inside there's really a mini-me, that's a mini-Don that runs all this stuff, that reacts to it. The belief also that the karma doesn't really make any difference, that I can kind of get by if nobody notices. At the next level, there's the once-returner. You hear about these things in the suttas, and that's why I'm just kind of mentioning them. There's the once-returner, and at that level, greed, hate, and delusion get attenuated, but they're still there. And the once-returner still has work to do unless he reaches one of the other stages. He or she has to come back to this world and do work for another lifetime before achieving final release. Then there's the non-returner, and the non-returner might not achieve liberation in this lifetime on Earth, but will go to a heavenly abode and finish the work there. Now, you don't have to believe that, but that's why they're called non-returners. And at that stage, what gets uprooted is hate, which is the first of the three roots, and also craving for sensual enjoyment. And that can mean not only touch, taste, hearing, smell, a sight, but thoughts, because in the Buddhist scheme of things, there are six sense doors, and the brain is one of them. They don't have this Cartesian idea that there's a brain back here looking at the world out there. The brain is part of the world in the same way that the eye and the ear is. And then the arhat. Then what gets dropped there is greed and delusion, and also pride, shamelessness, and a couple others. Mental torpor and restlessness. So if you've ever thought, you said, gee, I'm restless. Maybe when I get like Gil, I won't be restless anymore. Well, guess what? You have to be an arhat before you finally get rid of that one. And I mention that because those are on the list of hindrances. We'll come back. We'll see the hindrances here real soon. So the Buddha is talking about, when the Buddha talks about his gradual training, it always starts off with the Buddha coming into the world, teaching the Dhamma, and people hearing it and getting interested. It's like us. We're here. We're changing our lives in a way to come tonight and here, and later on we'll discuss the Dhamma. In the suttas, what happens is a man or a woman would leave home and ordain. That's the way that he's always giving most of his talks to monks and nuns. So that's the language that he used. But when we read the suttas, we can consider a bhikkhu or a bhikkhuni as just anybody who's, you know, truly dedicated to following the path. Doesn't have to be. So that can include us, too. We can include ourselves in that language. And then the monk goes forth. The person goes forth from home into homelessness, becomes a monk. And then the gradual training starts with sila, and sometimes you'll find some lists where they actually start with dana, which is generosity. And for lay people, that's considered very auspicious because you have a chance not to give something and make points with the Buddha, because he's not back up there keeping score. This is working. This is a chance for you to work on skillful intention. And if you were to give money, let's say you had a choice between putting your last $2 in the operations basket tonight, and you left, and he said, gee, I wish I hadn't done that. Now I have to go to the ATM, and I'm going to be home late, and I got to get up late, and all this. You know, it might have been better if you didn't do it, not because you're a bad person, but because, it just didn't work out for you. You might be better off just saying, well, I'll support it when I can. It's about intention rather than, you know, what it looks like to somebody else. So but in terms of sila, in terms of the gradual training, the monk would undertake first. It would undertake rules of discipline that were put in place to keep the community working well together, and also to give the individual monk chances to work mindfully on their own behavior. Ajahn Amaro talks about the precepts, which are, the monks have 227 rules, and nuns, unfortunately, have even more. But for lay people, we have far fewer. We have lists of various lengths called the precepts, and the most common one for us is not killing, not taking what is not given freely, refraining from sexual misconduct in whatever that means for you, given your situation and refraining from false speech, harsh speech, things like that, and refraining from drinks or drugs that cloud the mind. It's interesting. I was reading tonight in one of the suttas that lays out, you know, the original form of where some of these precepts come from, and they say non-killing. That's easy. You know, check. Not taking what is given, not given freely. Check. But when they get to speech, they go on and on and on. They say, "Oh, it's not wrong speech. It's harsh speech, frivolous speech, talking about people who aren't there." It's a big thing for us. It might be, we can probably go through. A lot of us can go through our whole lives and not kill another person or something like that. But boy, talking to them, that's where we really have trouble. So as I think I said, Ajahn Amaro calls the precepts speed bumps. They're, you know, like when you get off the, you start getting out of your lane in the freeway, you go thump, 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 thump. So the precepts are there to remind you that, oh, something important is happening here. It's not a rule that makes you bad or good. It's a rule that helps you understand when you're getting into territory where you really have to pay attention. Robert Aitken Roshi, who is or was a Zen Roshi in Hawaii, he says that precepts are what keeps our practice from becoming a hobby. So it kind of gets kind of like vinegar on the salad or something like that. It gives it a little bite. So it, and we're all invited to take precepts, our own precepts. You can take 2 out of 3, you can say, I'll take the fifth precept about refraining from drinks, but I'll interpret it, which is allowed under the, you know, it's a legitimate interpretation to say, yeah, I'll drink, but not to the point where I get goofy. I'll have a glass of wine with dinner. That's fine. You can set up your own the exact form of it isn't so important as the fact that you've got something you've promised yourself that you're going to try and do. And then, when you goof, then you get to notice what happened. So it's partly there for what happens when you make a mistake too. Then the next stage in this is contentment, and here I'll just read from the sutta. It says, "Just as a bird, wherever it goes, flies with its wings as its only burden, so too the bhikkhu becomes content with robes to protect his body and with alms food to maintain his stomach. And wherever he goes, he sets out with only these with him." So this isn't a vow of poverty. This is about being content. The Buddha said this is the middle way. He had been a prince. He knew what it was like to have all his needs tended for. He had 3 different palaces, one for each of the major seasons. And he was an ascetic. He lived eating a couple of grains of rice a day and walking around. He wore clothes made out of tree bark and owl's wings and stuff like that. He wasn't into either extreme. So this wasn't a vow of poverty or of hardship. This was making life simple for yourself. And perhaps for people that just go into homelessness, or perhaps if we decide that we're going to enter into some kind of renunciation for ourselves, maybe it's just no coffee afternoon. After 12 o'clock. I mean, it could be something like that. It can be a private one. It doesn't have to be a major one. You don't have to stand up and make a declaration of it. But you get to look at something and say, oh, well, you know, that actually does simplify my life. But I had to make some choices to do it, and I noticed how I reacted the first time I couldn't have that cup of coffee in the afternoon. I had to make some adjustments. Or maybe I was depending on it in some way I hadn't realized before. It just gives you a way to examine your life. So renunciation and contentment are a big part of this. I do want to point out that this, there's a series of more austere renunciations called Dutanga. And the Buddha recommended these to the monks undertake one or more of these for a series of time. So some of them are wearing patched up robes or robes that were made out of cast off rags, or eating only food that you gather on the alms round, going to every house on the alms round, not just the ones with the good cooks, refusing a second helping, dwelling in the forest or at the foot of a tree or in a cemetery, sleeping sitting up, never laying down. So some of these are actually kind of baked into the way that monasteries run. Some monasteries, it's one bowl a day. That's what they do. That's one meal a day. Some are just one bowl a day. It's the whole Thai forest tradition that grew up around people actually living in the forests and dealing with the fears of animals and the uncertainty that you have to deal with there. I mention this also because there's one Burmese monk who's famous for this, Thongpulu Sayadaw, and he founded a monastery here in Boulder Creek. I don't know if many of you know about that, but in the late 70s, he founded a monastery in Boulder Creek. So if you ever up that way, stop in. Then the next stage is, we're still kind of on sila here, but the next stage is restraint of the senses. And going back to one of the suttas, on seeing a form with the eye, the monk does not grasp at its signs and features. In sense, if she left the eye faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade her. She undertakes restraint of the eye faculty, and the same for the other sense doors. It's another name for them, sense doors, or sense fears sometime. Note that the Buddha is not saying, oh, the world's an evil place. This is not, I mean, there are some traditions that the world's an evil place. We're going to withdraw from the world because it pollutes us or something. The Buddha's saying, not saying that here. He's saying, you monk might have trouble with that. He says, so if you're trying to guard the sense door, the eye door, those Baywatch reruns are out. Okay, or whatever it is for you. Or if you find that that it gets harder not to have that second glass of wine because the first one tasted so good, maybe you're getting a little too wrapped up in the tongue, in the sense door of the tongue. It's not that those are bad. Clinging to them is bad. Enjoying them is not. And there's a difference. So eating a sundae and saying that was great, that's enjoying it. Saying, when can I have another one, is clinging to it. So that's the difference the Buddha's trying to get to here. In some of the suttas, there are some optional things here, moderation in eating and devotion to wakefulness. And we have a chance to do those on retreats. And if you're on a retreat, you can cut back on your meals. Some retreats called eight precept retreats. There's only two meals a day. No eating after lunch. The only thing you get in the afternoon is juice. And I'll tell you, for a guy that is I'm a confirmed food fan, and but it's possible. You can do that. You can go for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, not eating afternoon, and it's. Gives you new power to find out that you can do something. I never thought that was possible before. You can also cut back on your sleep a lot. You don't need 6-8 hours a night. You can get by in four. Some of you can get by in 5 or 4. And if you push that on a retreat, I'm not saying you try and do that during the workday, but during the work week, but things are easier on a retreat. You don't have to spend as much time going around being Don or Richard or Lewis. You can just kind of go around. That takes a lot of energy out of you, and you don't realize how hard it is until you let it go for a while. And you can get by with less on a retreat, and actually find some power in pushing yourself a little bit, finding that there's possibilities there, that you've got more reserves than you thought you did. So we're moving on here. The next step is mindfulness and full awareness. And the sutta goes on. The monk becomes one who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning, looking ahead and turning away, eating, drinking, tasting, walking, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking and keeping silent. Now, this isn't fancy stuff. This is just, these are the activities of daily life, and not even, you know, terribly fancy ones or involved ones. These are, but the Buddha, the Sutta talks about full awareness here, and sometimes it's also translated as clear comprehension. It's actually sampajanya, if you want to know the word. In the commentaries, that they kind of expand on it and break it out into things that I think help are interesting to us in terms of daily life. So, full awareness or clear comprehension has these four aspects. It's full awareness of the purpose of one's action. If you're thinking of taking an action, ask yourself, why are you doing it? You know, I found myself saying, oh, I'm doing this because of the war or the election or something like that. And I think, no, I'm doing it because I'm mad and I hate, you know, I just want to, you know, make life difficult for somebody or say something nasty about somebody. And so I said, oh, gee, that's not too, fortunately I can say that to myself. I don't have to say it to everybody, but well, maybe there's another way to accomplish the same thing that doesn't have all the negative consequences of, because, you know, if you pay attention, you notice that if you do something, make a snide remark or whatever, it'll revisit you. It'll come back and say, hey, remember me? Remember when you did that? And, you know, you get tired of that after a while, and sometimes it's just easier to drop them before you make them. Still, I'm still working on that one. Next one is full awareness of the suitability of one's means. This is exactly the opposite of the ends justify the means. In fact, I think we're invited here to look at how we, you know, we're a very goal-oriented society, at least around here in Silicon Valley. You know, I got to get the product launched. I got, you know, I have to-do list, management by objectives, and all that. And these objectives kind of take on a life of their own, right? They're bullets. You're on this page, and they're on your performance plan, and that's what they are. And then it seems like, well, we've decided on that, and now we have our choice about how we make things happen, as though the way that we go about doing them was different from our decision to do them in the first place. And at least in our personal life, that doesn't always have to be that way. I remember a lot of people talking about, well, that was a business decision. I said, no, it wasn't a business decision. It was a personal decision you were ashamed of, so you called it a business decision. Now, I'm not saying that it's easy to run a company or a country or anything else, but at least in our individual lives, in small areas, we have the luxury of considering goals and their implementation as one package and looking not at the action itself but the intention behind it, which is what the Buddha always pointed to. Two more aspects of this full awareness is one is not abandoning the subject of meditation. Now, this is assuming that you're meditating to begin with, but maybe there are times when you should start meditating. You say, oh, you know, I'm feeling that flushed feeling around my face and forehead that I usually associate with being really mad, so maybe it's time that I start breathing seriously and paying attention to that. Maybe, boy, if I could catch beforehand what I noticed afterwards more often, I'd be a lot happier guy. And you can start to do that. It's kind of, there's a window, a little window. It doesn't take long not to say something stupid. If you can just catch that, you can stop. Oh, I don't have to say that. I'll just hang back. And then the last one is the full awareness of reality. That's the behind all your actions. There's no abiding self. There's no me. There's no mine. This is not me. This is not mine. This is not who I am. Sometimes you just have to let go and just realize that. It may not be the best thing you can do ever, but for the time, it might be what you need to do. So we're moving on here. Possessing this aggregate of noble virtue. So the suttas, the sila was called this aggregate of noble virtue. Okay. And this noble restraint of faculties, and possessing this noble mindfulness and full awareness, the monk resorts to a secluded place, and on returning from his alms rounds after his meal, he sits down, folds his legs crosswise, sets erect, and establishes his mindfulness before him. All of this stuff was sila. All of this stuff was daily life. The contentment, the renunciation, the sampajanya, the full awareness. Now we're going to move into the part, the concentration area of the training. And the first thing that comes up after this is the monk has just sat down, establishes mindfulness before him, and the first thing that comes up is the hindrances. So he says, abandoning covetousness with regard to the world, the monk dwells with an awareness devoid of covetousness. He cleans his mind of covetousness, and so on with ill will and anger, sloth and drowsiness, restless and anxiety and uncertainty. Now, all of these are things that are on that list of kalesas, the ones that don't get wiped out until we're non-returners or arhats. So what are we doing here? Well, this is the part where we're working on the temporary suppression of what the latent the obsessive defilements. And you, if you've ever sat for half an hour, 45 minutes, or maybe three or four periods like that in a row and obsessed about being upset or wanting something, you know why they're called obsessive defilements. So what's going on here is the Buddha is saying these are five things that are really going to trip you up in your meditation. And he says they are so powerful that unless you get a handle on them, they're going to keep you from doing anything at all. So there are various ways to handle that. One way is to, this is where you can give talks on each one of these and spend a whole 45 minutes in that. But we're back at 30,000 feet. One way is to replace an unwholesome thought with a wholesome one. So you're sitting there thinking about getting cut off in traffic or what a colleague at work said, and you're just, you know, really steamed about that. And it's just saying, well, I'm not going to think about that. Just doesn't work. It doesn't work for you. So you can try replacing it with a wholesome thought. You might try doing metta for the person in the car that cut you off, or your friend at work, and perhaps that works. Perhaps that one doesn't work. Then you can try thinking about the unwholesome effects of the thought you're having. So if you're having lustful thoughts, you're at a retreat. They always talk about the Vipassana romance, the person across the room of the appropriate sex that you're sure is the person you should be with. You know, if only you could meet, you know, and talk. And so I think, well, no, you know, I already have a wonderful person of the appropriate sex, and this is just going to, you know, this is, you know, I don't want to go there. This is just going to, it's a long retreat. It's too early to start getting lustful thoughts. You try and cut it off. The Buddha gives a list of these, and the last one on the list is sitting there gritting your teeth and pressing your tongue on the roof of your mouth. So, I usually give up before then, but that's the one on the Buddha's list. So then, having done that, having suppressed these things just enough so that we can sit down and concentrate. Now, we may suppress anger, and it'll still be there. We suppressed anger enough that we can pay attention to it in minute detail. It doesn't go away. It might not even go away in the course of our meditation. It may, in turn, become the object of our meditation. We may look at it, but not in terms of the story we're telling ourselves about being cut off in traffic, but about the fact of having anger. So we may say, "Oh, this is anger. This is what anger feels like. This is what it feels like in the body. Here's how it came up. Here's what happens when I feed it." And here's what happens when I don't feed it. If I don't do the, it's going away. It's changing. That's part of the meditation that we can get into. But first, we're going to the jhanas. And that's because that's the next thing in this going to have to stop soon. That's the next thing in this in the gradual training is the jhanas, and these are the meditative states. There's four of them we're talking about here. That are their concentration in the sense that the mind is always looking at the same thing. There's another sense in which we talk about concentration here, which the mind is always looking at whatever is most prominent, rather than going off and getting involved in a story. This is a different kind, where the mind is always being involved in the same thing. For example, if you do metta, and you keep saying the same phrases over and over and over, that's a jhana. And so this is also what the Buddha means when he talks about right concentration. When they talk about right concentration in the Eightfold Path, the example is always the four jhanas. So we're in something of a I have to admit that there's a little bit of there's a discussion here. This is an active discussion area. Are the jhanas prerequisites? I mean, they come. The next item in the list is mindfulness meditation. So, are we supposed to master the four jhanas before we do mindfulness, or are they there in the sense that you don't have to master the second step of the Eightfold Path before you undertake the third? They're all kind of mixed in. You take you work on whichever one you can, and they kind of, you know, interact and build each other up. And that is a topic of some discussion. The way that it tends to work in this tradition here, the Mahasi method, coming out of Burma. Is that people, the teachers stress concentration, stress using the tools that show up in jhana, applied in a different way to insight meditation. So if you go back and you read the description of the jhanas here, I'll read a couple of them, and. This is Sariputta talking about these instances. And what, friends, is right concentration? Here, quite secluded from sensual pleasures. Oh, by the way, when they say secluded in this sense, that's guarding the eye doors. It doesn't mean physical isolation. So sometimes in the suttas you say, oh, and Moggallana, having arisen from his seclusion. No, that just means he got up from meditation. He was, you know, not looking at things, not he was deep in meditation. So here, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states. That's that work on the hindrances. A bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. And it goes on. So, applied thought and sustained thought. That's vitaka and vichara. Right. So this is the simile. There is like a bee flying up to a flower. So the bee flying up to the flower is the applied thought, and then the sustained thought is the bee stays there. And the sustained thought, vichara, is one of the elements. Seven factors of enlightenment. In fact, if you go through this list of the description of the jhanas, most of the factors of enlightenment are in there and show up as stages of the jhanas, the first four jhanas. So my provisional and personal understanding is, and you're warned not to adopt this unless you have other evidence than mine that it's right, is that what the Buddha did is took these well-proven and very powerful tools, mindfulness, investigation, energy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity, that show up either explicitly or implicitly in the first four jhanas in every description of them, and put them to a different purpose. Because what the Buddha liked the power of the jhanas, he just didn't like the result. He said, it doesn't go far enough. When I get up from my jhanas, I still have these defilements. So he took the tools and applied them to looking at things as they really are. And that's the final step. Actually, I'm going to skip. There's a few more steps in here. I'm going to run a bit over. I just want to tell you this anyway. So after having the jhanas, in some lists there are talks about having supernormal powers of one kind or another. And the Buddha said, you can go ahead and do those. Those aren't necessary for being released, but they're available, and some people want to do them. And this is a little book. There's a copy in the library. It's called Knee Deep in Grace. It's a story by this amazing woman called Deepa Ma. And I first heard about her from Sharon Salzberg. And Sharon Salzberg was one of Deepa Ma's students. And Sharon Salzberg said, we were meditating, and then Deepa Ma just got up and walked through the wall. And then came back like nothing had happened, sat down again. And there are more stories in this book, but these things apparently still happen today. These marvelous but mundane powers that you can get from concentration. But the final stage in the gradual teaching, the Buddha introduces like this. When his concentrated mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, the monk directs it to knowledge of the destruction of taints. Taints, cankers, effluence, those guys. He understands as it actually is, this is suffering. He understands as it actually is, this is the cessation of suffering. He understands as it actually is, this is the way to the cessation of suffering. And that's basically the Four Noble Truths. Buddha doesn't say how you get there here, but in other suttas, he makes it very clear, and our tradition really buys into it, that the method for doing that is Vipassana, or mindfulness meditation. And in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness treatment, you have the paying attention to the body and the breath, paying attention to sensations, whether the physical or mental, that are pleasant, unpleasant, or neither, paying attention to thoughts, and paying attention just to states of mind. You use these tools that the Buddha talked about, kind of borrowed, if I understand it, from the jhanas, use it to make the mind concentrated enough so you can look at something close up without blinking. It's not like X-ray vision where you're just kind of blasting me like it's... X-ray vision seems kind of impersonal to me, the Superman idea of X-ray vision. I think of getting up close to something so you don't blink. It has more of the sense of intimacy that I find valuable here. And in the course of this, in the fourth foundation, what you're asked to do is look at some of these dhammas that you look at are the hindrances and the seven factors of enlightenment. So you're asked to notice, are the hindrances there? How did they get here? What happens if I feed them? What happens if I don't feed them? How do they rise? How do they pass away? Not just to know and see them as they actually are, and you get to see things that are more and more subtle. And also in doing so, you gain some skill in dealing with them. You'll find out that you have a little more choice in how you handle anger, both on your cushion and in daily life. And I should stop now. That is the gradual training at 30,000 feet. Okay. So we've got time for questions or observations or discussion. Everything was clear, right? Yeah.
You mentioned four jhanas.
Yeah.
And so that would be the Rupa jhanas.
Yeah.
Was it intentional to leave out the arupa jhanas, the next four, or?
Yeah. So there's it, what Richard's talking about is there are other lists. There's a set of eight absorptions, and the first one are called material, and those are the things that are called jhanas, and they're 1, 2, 3, and 4. That's all they are. Above that, they're called immaterial because. And they actually have names like the base of the base of infinite space or something like that. They actually have names. I don't know what the Buddha thought, what was intentional, but all eight of them aren't part of the definition of right mindfulness. Right concentration in the Eightfold Path. It was just the first four jhanas. I asked the same question, and that's the answer I got, and that's. I think it's kind of like those things are available to you. You don't need them, just like you don't need to develop the ability to see past lives or to see where other people go, what their destination in this world or others is after they die. They can be useful, but they're not part of the path. Okay. Well, we have some time. I'll read you this thing. I wanted to read you this anyway. This is. I've met people that have met Deepa Ma. Guy Armstrong. You know Guy Armstrong from Spirit Rock. Yeah, he spent 3 months with her. Just hanging around. And let's see. So Jack Engler, who's an old Vipassana guy and a psychologist, once asked Deepa Ma if she still possessed the psychic power she had acquired years before while studying with Munindra. Munindra is Joseph Goldstein's first teacher. Okay. No, she said. Well, could you get them back? Yes, she said, but it would take a long time. How long? Asked Jack, thinking that she would reply in terms of months or years. Oh, about 3 days, she replied, if I really practiced. There are said to be 6 higher powers, 5 mundane powers accessed through the extraordinary degree of concentration in the fourth jhana, and 1 supramundane power attained only through insight practice and considered a mark of full enlightenment. The 5 mundane powers are found in all shamanic and yogic traditions and occur spontaneously to a lesser extent in some individuals. They are magical powers, such as the ability to transform one of the 4 basic elements of the physical world, earth, air, fire, and water, into one another. The divine ear, the ability to hear sounds near and far on earth and in other realms. The divine eye, the ability to see into the future, to see things near and far on earth and in other realms. Knowledge of one's former births and previous births of others. Knowledge of the states of mind of other beings, that is, the ability to read or know the minds of others. Deepa Ma demonstrated each of these powers to Munindra, who confirmed her mastery of them. The following accounts are based on his recollections and the recollections of some of her students. Once Munindra was in his room when he noticed something unusual in the sky outside his window. He looked out and saw Deepa Ma in the air near the tops of the trees grinning at him and playing in a room she had built in the sky. By changing the air elements into the earth element, she had been able to create a structure in midair. Changing denser elements to air produced only slightly less astonishing occurrences. Sometimes Deepa Ma and her sister Hema arrived for interviews with Munindra by spontaneously appearing in his room, and Deepa Ma occasionally left by walking through the closed door. If she was feeling especially playful, she might rise from her chair, go to the nearest wall, and walk right through it. Deepa Ma learned to cook by making the fire element come out of her hands. She would also change the earth element into the water element, which she demonstrated to Munindra by diving into a patch of ground and emerging with her clothes and hair wet. If she had to walk alone at night, Deepa Ma could duplicate her body, creating a companion for herself so that no one would bother her. Deepa Ma's abilities in this regard were once tested and confirmed by a third party. Manindra knew a professor of ancient Indian history at Magad University who was skeptical about psychic powers. Manindra offered to prove the existence of such powers, and the two of them set up an experiment. The professor posted a trusted graduate student in a room where Deepa Ma was meditating to watch and make sure she didn't leave the room. On the appointed day, the student verified that Deepa Ma never left her meditation posture, and yet, at the very same time, she approached the professor's office 10 miles away and had a conversation with him. Deepa Ma and Hima, her sister was equally gifted, or nearly so. Deepa Ma and Hima once used their psychic powers in tandem to move a bus. One afternoon in Rangoon, they were waiting at a bus stop. When the bus finally arrived, over an hour late, they realized they were going to miss their engagement some distance away. Because it was important to arrive on time, they both began to concentrate and got the bus back on schedule. During the samadhi state, Manindra explained, they made resolutions and moved the bus even while sitting in it. They shortened the time and the distance. It can be done. The Buddha did this with Angulimala. When Angulimala was trying to catch the Buddha, he kept running after him, but the Buddha didn't move, and still he could not catch him. This was because the Buddha used his powers to make the distance always the same. It is a simple thing. So that's what Manindra... You may or may not believe that, but I know people that I respect who do, and I just thought it was kind of interesting to know that this stuff isn't always from times 2,500 years ago. So maybe we'll just sit for about 5 minutes, okay? Okay.